You are tuned to WUSB Stony Brook, 90.1 FM, 107.3 FM, or listening on the web, WUSB FM. 8 o'clock on a Wednesday night, time for Davy Jones Locker.
When he fell to earth in 1972 and changed the face and direction of popular music, my guest was rightly hailed as a genius, David Bowie!
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to London, to Wembley and Live Aid. Will you meet and greet David Bowie?
Ladies and gentlemen, David Bowie.
And the house lights were about to go down for the appearance of David Bowie.
He rose to fame as a fabulous illusionist of rock.
Small genius, snuck off from the city.
Ever-changing, always outrageous, and more bizarre by the moment.
When David Bowie releases a new album, it's a major event within the rock world. Bowie's influence has always been more inside than out. He invented heavy metal, new wave, and influenced the sound and the look of rock for more than a generation. His name originally was David Jones.
Davy Jones Locker!
We don't want to go down to Davy Jones' locker. No, we don't want to go down to Davy Jones' locker.
David Bowie's Space Oddity here on Davy Jones Locker on WUSB. That is from pianist Harriet Stubbs' latest album, Living on Mars. Davy Jones Locker features on anything and everything connected to David Bowie, from his music to musicians who have played with him, their music, and to covers by other artists. Living on Mars, the album from Harriet, was produced by longtime Bowie keyboardist Mike Garson, and features not only classical music, but interpretations of current music by artists such as Coldplay to Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. I had the pleasure of talking with Harriet last week about her career, albums, and current and future projects. Here is that interview now. So today we're talking with Harriet Stubbs. Harriet has a new album out called Living on Mars that was produced by Mike Garson, longtime David Bowie collaborator. Good evening, Harriet. How are you?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. We're going to do a brief overview of your career. I mean, you were a child prodigy. You started playing piano around the age of 3. Were your parents musicians?
My mother played. Yes, she did. She went to music college. So she taught me when I was very little before I went to junior Guildhall. Yeah. There was a lot of music. There was a lot of classical music. There was also a lot of other music. And then really as a teenager, I sort of developed my interests in rock and roll and in lots of things outside of classical, going to Glastonbury and discovering who I was outside of, you know, child prodigy and then deciding what I'd end up doing with my career in the end.
Now, you started performing publicly a year later. Was this something that your parents pushed you into, or is this something that you wanted to do?
I just don't remember. I think that if you have a gifted child, there's no perfect way to do anything. You know, you have to push them very hard in order for them to reach their potential. And if you don't, then, you know, I think it's very difficult to know what the right thing to do. I certainly wouldn't know what it would be.
When you started, there was no social media, really, YouTube. And it seems nowadays, you know, every time you look, there's somebody being pushed as the next child prodigy. Do you feel that's a good thing to do, or is that a bad thing to do? You think you develop better without that pressure on you and that audience?
I think it's very difficult. I think that if you don't start at a very young age, then you do have certain disadvantages if you want to go into it professionally. Your developing mind learns everything faster, you know, whether it's languages or, you know, you speak to children that have parents that speak different languages and they're always disappointed if they didn't learn the language of the other parent because it's so much harder to learn as an adult. So I do think there's great benefits to learning very young. And it develops all sorts of other parts of your personality and learning abilities. I think if you're doing it as a career at that age, it's incredibly pressured. I'm not sure that the same career that was available to full-time classical musician is the same as what it was 20 years ago. And I think that perhaps the time of the child prodigy and all the different things that that might mean has changed since my time. I think that there's a difference between a child that has just been taught to do something by rote for a very long time, you know, with parents that are determined to turn them into stars, to children that have something very natural and very special, and the space to define those in a sophisticated way is even smaller with the way that people now consume music. Everything is about supposed audience online rather than that genuine connection. But actually, when it comes to the concerts themselves, either people are connecting with something real or they're not, and they can tell the difference between that. And so it always does come back to the same value. But what that means for the sort of hot air in between, I think, has changed over the years.
Now, your earliest memories of playing, did you start probably solo piano? And then when did you start developing playing with, say, a small ensemble or an orchestra?
I was playing with ensembles at 4 or 5. I was very, very young when I was admitted to Junior Guildhall, which is a music conservatoire, kind of like Juilliard or MSM here. And I was in a trio, we would perform. But as a soloist, with an orchestra accompanying me. It's my first piano concerto. I think I was 8. And I think even to this day, that's still my favorite way to perform. You feel like you have this sort of army of musicians there to play with you, and there's so much dialogue, and the music is always so gorgeous for concertos. It's always a real privilege to play.
That was an excerpt of Finchie's Ecloque for piano and strings that was performed by Harriet Stubbs at age 12 with the Guildhall Symphony Orchestra. You are tuned to WUSB 90.1 FM and 107.3 FM. This is Davy Jones Locker. I'm Steve Kreitzer. And tonight we are talking with pianist Harriet Stubbs, whose latest album is Living on Mars. Let's go back to the interview. So at the age of 5, you won a full scholarship to the Guildhall School of Music and Drama. You need to audition for that.
Yeah, I think I was their youngest that they ever accepted. And I had a full scholarship for the 10 years that I was there.
Quite a list of alumni from that school. I mean, it includes everyone from James Galway to George Martin, even to folks in jazz such as Dave Holland, who was a bassist for Miles Davis. What were the teachers like? We have an impression here of the, you know, the English schools, the stern taskmaster with the little ruler banging and, you know, do it again, do it again. What was it like for you?
I think actually I was so fortunate. I was taught by Jimmy Gibb, who was actually from, you know, the adult college. And he was, I think even when he took me on, he was in his early 80s. And he didn't teach children. And he finally made an exception for me. And so he wasn't interested in any of that. He was just a very serious musician, believed in honest and good playing and bringing out the best. You know, I think he was very focused on me having a career that was just as important as an adult as it was as a child, and developing me to be a real musician in everything that I played, not just, you know, the flashiest repertoire.
From there, you went to Trinity Laban School of Music. And again, another competitive school. Only 10% of applicants are admitted. one of the most selective schools in, you know, England and Europe. Why not stay at Guildhall? What made you decide to go to Trinity?
Guildhall were brilliant to me. I think that I just wanted to do something as an adult where I wasn't known as a child prodigy and just have an opportunity to sort of come in unknown. I think that was appealing to me. Yeah.
At 13, you were on ITV's Britain's Brilliant Prodigies, and you placed in the top three as, you know, one of the top three instrumentalist pianists in the country. That must have been quite a shock for you, I guess. Here you are playing with another small orchestra, small groups, and now you're in front of millions of people. Did you feel the pressure, or?
You know, I think as a child, when I performed, I was rarely nervous. I was just very excited. I don't think you're ever nervous until the first time you feel nervous. Then it just gets worse as you get older, I think. It actually, as a child, you have this sort of sense of invincibility because nothing's gone wrong yet. So and I think that at that age, I was just so excited to be involved, and performing genuinely was a real joy. Yeah.
From then on, you moved to New York for your graduate and master's degree. You applied to and accepted to the Manhattan School of Music. Why New York? Why not someplace such as Boston with the Boston Conservatory, or, and why Manhattan School of Music instead of, say, Juilliard?
I think I had decided when I was about 6 years old that I was going to move to New York. I was determined, even though I didn't really know what that meant. And I really, that was the deal that I'd made with myself when I was very young. It was very long hours of practice where I would be up at 3 a.m. doing 5 hours before school and then 3 hours when I came back from school. You know, at 6 years old, that's a lot to do. And I think that I'd sort of said, well, one day I'm going to move to New York. And I also, again, really wanted to develop a career on my own terms as an adult and find what I wanted to do with it that was going to be original and meaningful. And I also felt that the American market were more open to the idea of a portfolio career, whereas at the time, it's changed a lot now, but the UK was less open to that. And so I wanted to really see what was possible and also develop ideas from a totally different approach to teaching, really.
Between your graduation from the Manhattan School of Music to 2018, when you released Heaven and Hell, The Doors of Perception, what were you doing in that period?
I was really developing a life outside of the classical music scene in New York. And I'd moved to the East Village. I was developing my relationships, my community, exploring the rich tapestry that was all the other arts in New York. And it's how I really came together with the very organic project that was Heaven and Hell. It was it told the story of my life at that time. And I think it couldn't have happened without me taking that time to really develop a life outside of the classical music scene.
In making the album Heaven and Hell, The Doors of Perception, you were a fan of William Blake and his book, The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. He believed there were two types of people that existed, energetic creators and rational organizers. Which one are you?
Oh, you know, I think I adore Blake, of course. I like to think of myself as energetic and also rational. I think that at the time, a lot of the influence behind him saying things like that as well were his upset at this sort of industrial revolution. And you know, I remember him not being a particularly big fan of Isaac Newton. But I think that if he'd lived longer, he would have been a fan of all of that. But I think that really it was about he was just such a supporter of purity, and that's where that came from. And you know, exuberance is eternal delight, and I think that's really where that came from. And I like to live my life along those lines. I find it very helpful.
A lot of what we call black death heavy metal bands have used his works for albums. One group from Norway, Ulver, actually took their lyrics taken from his book They combined industrial, electronic, metal, ambient type of music. Were you aware of other interpretations of Blake's work in music before you made the album?
No, I became aware of them as people started interviewing me once the album went out. And I had all sorts of people writing to me. And I was so excited that so many other musicians had been touched by Blake. I really was so excited to find this whole community that existed all over the world of people that had done this. It's amazing, just amazing.
Now, what went into the selecting the music that you used for the album?
It was really my relationship with Russ Titelman that had a big part in how we put the album together. Russ and I actually met at Barney Greengrass through a friend of ours, Julian Tepper, who's a writer. And we sort of got to know each other over a couple of years over milkshakes. And then one day we went into the studio at Jacob Burns in Pleasantville, recorded one piece, decided to make an album. And then the album really came together very slowly over a few years, where we selected something together. I went and learned it. Then we would record it. So very unlike the following album, complete opposite. And sometimes we'd, you know, I'd go and learn something and then we'd go and we'd say, actually, it doesn't fit. We chose the order based on the narrative that Marianne Faithfull set up. But in terms of the repertoire, and it was also about repertoire that we both loved and that we came together and appreciating and had, you know, decided was going to work.
So Russ Titelman, he's a famous producer. He's worked with Eric Clapton, Steve Winwood, Cyndi Lauper, Ricky Lee Jones, James Taylor. This was his first classical album. Was he a little intimidated doing this? Do you know? And how did you feel working with someone who didn't have that classical background?
I was excited to work with somebody that had a very rich musical knowledge and appreciation and experience, because I felt that his take was fresh. It had quality, but it was fresh on this particular genre and came from a place of curiosity and newness. And I felt that that really set into motion what I was trying to say with classical music, how it doesn't need to be somebody that has studied it for 60 years to appreciate what moves them. And because I was interested in telling the story through Blake, you know, when we first met, we weren't going to do a project together because we did very different things. And it was really Blake that brought us together and that idea of how would he do his first classical album and why and what would it be? And it was because we had that story to tell that we came together to make the album.
How did Marianne Faithfull get involved to do the narration for the first cut of the album? Hopefully I pronounced it right. Frisian Gates?
Yes. So John Adams very kindly let us use a segment of Frisian Gates because the whole piece is 30-something minutes, so we couldn't use the whole thing. But we explained what we wanted to do, and he was very supportive of it. Russ knew Marianne, and so he contacted her and asked her, and she recorded four different versions from Paris. Each version was a little different. She put quirks in, and they were all so fun and thoroughly Marianne. You know, I wish we could have released four sort of different versions and had them all out in the world. It was so difficult to choose, so they were all so special.
Rintra roars and shakes his fires in the burdened air. Hungry clouds swag on the deep. Without contraries, there is no progression, attraction and repulsion. Reason and energy, love and hate, are necessary to human existence. From these contraries spring what the religious call good and evil. Good is the passive that obeys reason. Evil is the active, springing from energy. Good is heaven. Evil is hell. As I was walking among the fires of hell, delighted with the enjoyments of genius, to which angels look like torment and insanity, I collected some of their proverbs. The road of excess leads to the palace of wisdom. The roaring of lions, the howling of wolves, the raging of the stormy sea, and the destructiveness of the sword are portions of eternity too great for the eye of man. Everything is possible. To be believed is an image of truth. The tigers of wrath are wiser than the horses of instruction. Never know what is enough unless you know what is more than enough. Exuberance is beauty. Sooner murder an infant in its cradle than nurse enacted desires. Thus, men forgot all deities reside in the human breast. For the cherub with his flaming sword is hereby commanded to leave his guard at the tree of life. And when he does, the whole creation will be consumed and appear infinite and holy, whereas it now appears finite and corrupt. This will come to pass by an improvement in sensual enjoyment. But first, the notion that man has a body distinct from his soul is to be expunged. This I shall do by printing in the infernal method of corrosives, which in hell are salutary and medicinal, melting apparent surfaces away and deploying the infinite which was hid. For man has closed himself up till he sees all things through narrow chinks of his cavern. if the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear to man as it is. Infinite.
Phrygian Gates, written by composer John Adams between 1977 and 1978, with piano from Harriet Stubbs and narration from Marianne Faithful. That's from Harriet's first album, Heaven and Hell, The Doors of Perception, and that was based on William Blake's book, The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, from the 1790s. You are tuned to WUSB 90.1 FM, 107.3 FM, and streaming on the web at WUSB.FM. The show is Davy Jones Locker. I'm Steve Kreitzer, and tonight we are talking with pianist Harriet Stubbs, whose latest album is Living on Mars. That was produced by longtime Bowie keyboardist Mike Garson, and I had the pleasure of speaking to Harriet last week. Why don't we go back and talk some more?
After the release of the album, we're planning on doing a bunch of concert series in the Cayman Islands. How did someone from England transplanted to New York wind up in the Cayman Islands?
During the process of putting out the first album, it was my first commercial album, and I learned a lot about the music industry in a very short time. And the more you learn, the more you realize how little you know. You know, it's that process all the time. And it was overwhelming and at times rather isolating as a sort of this escalation of knowledge and this huge campaign and all the different things that I was learning so quickly. And I found that diving became my escape from that. And it became a really big part of my life. And I started in the Arctic freediving with Orca, doing herring migration research trips with Basking Shark Scotland. And that's how my real love of the water developed. And then I started diving Catalina Island. I got my dive master. So I had scuba and I also did freediving. I went to the Cayman Islands in 2018 for the first time to dive. I had just finished the tour for Heaven and Hell. I fell in love with it. It was my first experience of warm water diving, actually. I was like, wow, what's this? and so the idea to do a series there developed over sort of multiple trips. I went back for Christmas, I went back in the spring. And then by the end of 2019, I'd put together a sort of $7.5 million big project that we're still waiting to do our first year as the pandemic sort of paused it. It was the first ever stage set in open water. It benefited the Central Caribbean Marine Institute, who I helped rebuild their coral reefs. Had the approval of the government and all of the sort of most senior members of the Cayman Islands. So I became very involved in Cayman and still very fond of it and look forward to being able to do it as we come out of the sort of post-pandemic years.
Quite an unusual hobby there, I guess, you know, as a musician. There's a lot of dangers involved in free diving, especially the pressure on the ears. Was that a concern of yours or you just threw caution to the wind?
There's been lots of things that I haven't been allowed to do because of the piano, you know, tennis and skiing. And I'm very careful with my hands. I wear very special gloves. But I really loved it. And I feel that I have to stay sane as well, you know.
Now, we had the global pandemic around 2019, 2020. You were in England at the time. You went on to give over 250 performances from your home in London. What led to that like open air daily concert?
Well, I thought I was going to London for a week. I didn't think I was going for 18 months. So when I got there, like everyone, you know, we thought it was going to be a very short time at the beginning. And it was very difficult to find any way to meaningfully contribute to this time, which unless you were in medicine, you know, what could you possibly do to help other people? And, you know, the days sort of bled into each other and it was really, what, you know, what do we miss the most? And really, I think that it was routine. And the sense of routine that people were starting to get was their daily walk that they were allowed to do. So I started timing it with the time that people did that, just so that when they were on their way from, you know, picking up their children, if they were going to school at the time, when it, you know, it was in and out of them going back to school, not going to school, or, you know, the time that people tended to go out at 5 o'clock, I would just put my window up and start playing, and people started gathering. Then I really started advertising it because people were really enjoying it. And, you know, the first part of the pandemic, it was on a corner with four different directions of traffic, and it was very noisy, and the weather was terrible most of the time, and everyone was wearing masks and distance from each other. And then as the vaccine started to be rolled out, restrictions started to lift. I also moved onto a much quieter street with a bigger piano and a bay window that people could really see out of, but they could also enjoy a glass of wine afterwards. And so it was, went through a big, big journey from beginning to end. Yeah.
Did you receive requests for certain pieces of music while you were doing this, or was this what you chose every day?
I never really opened the door to requests. You know, it was a 20-minute concert that had to be prepared. That was quite a lot of work for 250 days in a row. So there was no kind of room to do anything outside of that. It was, they came around so quickly. I mean, 7 days a week performing every day, you know, you go to bed and you're like, my God, I've got another concert. So yeah, it was a lot.
You were recognized for your efforts in 2022. You awarded the British Empire Medal. That is given by Queen Elizabeth. Were you aware you were nominated or even, you know, suggested for such a prestigious award? You know, what was your reaction and what was it like meeting the Queen?
I didn't know. The letter arrived in the UK when I was in New York. Thank goodness I'd asked someone to check my post, or I would have missed the deadline to respond. and my friend Monica sort of called me and said that there was a letter on Her Majesty's service. And I thought, what is this about? and she opened it. And it was really, really exciting. And so Her Majesty actually died between awarding it and the investiture. So she died in September of 2022, and she awarded it in her birthday honours list in June of 2022. So I never got to meet her, which was very sad, but I'm really glad that it was her, you know, very special.
Moving on, now it's 2023 and you start working on your latest album, Living on Mars, produced by Mike Garson, longtime member of David Bowie, as we mentioned earlier. How did you two meet?
We were both Yamaha artists in New York, and just before, well, at the beginning of 2019, I'd gone to visit Mike at his house in Bell Canyon. He had a beautiful studio there. We sort of talked about the album that we wanted to do. I played for him. And then unfortunately, due to the California fires, we lost some of the project that we'd put together. And then as time passed, the pandemic came. And so we didn't really get another opportunity to do it until 2023. But also the idea had developed, and over the course of the pandemic, you know, years had gone by. So the album that we ended up doing had come a long way from our original idea, which had been, you know, maybe it was going to be all Bowie, you know, what was it going to be? And all the ideas that came out of that time and the relationships that I built and things that influenced it, it, you know, it came at the right time in the end, even though it didn't feel like it in 2019.
You have a classical background. Mike Garson has that avant-garde jazz, I guess you can call it discordant style of playing. How difficult was it for you to move on from your classical training to kind of get into the feel of what he does?
Mike has full classical chops and understanding of classical harmony and jazz harmony, and is a really well-rounded and high-level musician. And so his approach to writing around and arranging popular or rock and roll are usually based on his improvisations that he does live. So they have a very organic feel, but they also are very fulfilling as a musician to play because they're written by a musician that truly has such a deep knowledge of so many styles of music and how to write pianistically. And that's a very unique skill set. And Mike is just so gifted. And I think we came with a very similar attitude and set of interests. And we wanted to put the classical in rock and roll as much as the rock and roll in classical. You know, the Chopin Godowsky on the album is a classic example of that. And that was really the vision of the album, rather than that it would just include melodies that people recognized. It was about much more, it was about expanding both genres rather than diminishing either of them.
How different were the recording sessions, that with Mike Garthen and the ones you had with Russ Titelman?
Completely different, which is wonderful because I learned two very different skill sets. Russ and I recorded Heaven and Hell over a couple of years in Astoria, Samurai Studio. I knew the piano that I was going into every day. I got hours to sort of practice on it beforehand, years to decide what we were going to do. In a way, Mike and I had years to decide what we were going to do, but not really, because when we decided we were going to record it, I had 3 weeks. So half the album I had been performing in concerts and half of it was much newer. We recorded it all in 2 days. We did half the album on one day, half the album the next day, no editing. I don't think we went in with the idea that it would deliberately be no editing, but the takes were going well. It felt good. And then it became, I don't want to edit anything because we've got come this far and we have such little time. So I want that to be a decision that we've made. And when it came to the Chopin Godowsky, doing it in one take, you know, I remember us sitting before doing it and I said, it's going to be by far the hardest one to do in one take. And somehow it happened. And, you know, the average classical recording is edited every 25 seconds or something. So to have it at that standard, but without any editing, and to do something that hard, which was, you know, Chopin etude and a Godowsky etude, and then made even more difficult by Mike, was certainly nerve-wracking, but really exhilarating. And I think that it adds something to the album to have been played in that way.
From Harriet Stubbs' latest album, Living on Mars, that was the Chopin Godowsky homage, based on Leopold Godowsky's arrangement of Frédéric Chopin's Etudes. Interesting, Chopin was also a child prodigy, as
is Harriet. And that piece there is renowned among pianists as one of the most technically difficult pieces to play. And they have it done in one take is pretty amazing. Harriet Stubbs. Here on Davy Jones Locker, my name is Steve Kreitzer. The show is all about anything and everything to do with David Bowie, from music, his music, to musicians who've played with him, to their music, to interviews with musicians related to his music, and even playing covers by other artists. But tonight, we are having a special show dedicated and focusing on Harriet Stubbs, a world-renowned pianist who has an album out called Living on Mars, which features two David Bowie tunes. One we started the show off, Space Oddity, and of course one we played, I think, last time I was on the air, Life on Mars. If you're interested in anything by Harriet, you want to check her out, she has a website, www.harrietstubbs.com. She's also can be found on Instagram, Spotify, YouTube, and other sites. Once again, if you'd like to see her, she'll be appearing at City Vineyard on January 21st, a Tuesday night. That's on the Hudson River Piers at 233 West Street, Pier 26. And Harriet will be focusing on the album, Living on Mars. So why don't we get back to the interview? This is Harriet Stubbs here on Davy Jones Locker on WUSB.
So there's a mix of classical, you mentioned Beethoven in a Bach piece, but there's also contemporary such as Coldplay and Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. Nick Cave, you know, I consider him more of a lyricist. You know, you did the song Push the Sky Away. How did that come into play?
So Nick and I are good friends. We are swimming partners. I had told Nick, you know, there was a period where we were swimming every day together and we'd have, you know, sort of 45-minute walk on the way there and on the way back through the park, and we'd talk about what we were playing, what we were reading. And I'd said that, you know, Mike and I had had this idea of the project, but we hadn't, you know, recorded it yet. And on New Year's Day of 2023, we went for a swim and it was very early in the morning, so it was dark, and he announced that he was going to start writing his new album, which ended up being Wild God that day. And he said, you know, you should really get going on your Mike Garson project. And it was just that push. And I told Mike, and I think he was excited that Nick was excited about it and didn't tell me he was going to do it, but then wrote this beautiful arrangement of Push the Sky Away. And Nick said, oh, are you going to put it on the album? And as it became the centerpiece. And I didn't even think about it at the time. It actually occurred to me after the album had been recorded, but it's that big D minor middle, which the Bach Rossini was on Heaven and Hell. And I really hadn't thought about it in that way at all. We, you know, it just put it together as I thought the music made sense. But it's interesting that it has that parallel and that it's Nick Cave versus Bach Rossini. I find that, you know, quite funny.
Thank you.
Push the Sky, as performed by Harriet Stubbs. That was a Mike Garson arrangement of the Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds song. You're tuned to WUSB. This is Davy Jones Locker. I'm Steve Kreitzer. Tonight we are talking with pianist Harriet Stubbs, whose latest album is called Living on Mars. And why don't we go back to the interview as time is running out? We'll have some information about Harriet after we wrap up the interview. Harriet Stubbs on Davy Jones Locker.
The album Living on Mars was, you submitted it for Grammy nomination. Unfortunately, it wasn't selected. You once said you didn't want to perform straight musical in straight musical venues. You wanted to do something much bigger to reach spaces that classical music had never been before. Do you feel the Grammy committee is maybe too stuck and too staid in their ways to appreciate an artist that would mix classical with contemporary music?
No, I think that it's just such a huge volume of music in the first round. And I think that it's very difficult to reach the thousands and thousands of voting members, of which I'm one as well. And it's a very overwhelming process to be able to get through all of the repertoire in a very short time. And they've actually made the time shorter. You know, this year it was 10 days. And unless you have nothing else to do, that's very, very difficult to listen to everything that has been submitted. And I think that that process is very difficult to do an honest job of every category that you would like to listen to and have listened to every entry. And, you know, the larger the advertising campaign that you're able to do, the easier it is. I think that also some people just vote for what they know. And it's very difficult to get that right, I think.
Okay, in the meantime, you've created a podcast, The Piano with Harriet Stubbs. How did that come about, and what do you hope to accomplish with the podcast?
It came about because I met a photographer and videographer who thought that it would be great fun. He was another swimmer. I mean, swimming leads to everything. And I was intrigued by the idea. It came very naturally at the time. It was a large part of 2022. At the time, I was redeveloping the Cayman project as well as we came out of the pandemic, but they still weren't ready. And I was still waiting to go and do my album. And so it was such a great period of time. And I really interviewed the people that I have relationships with that I felt had meaningful contributions, and every episode was about something I was performing or that I was doing. And at the time, it was a huge process of memorization, of learning, of developing as a musician, because I had the time and the space to do that. So all the lessons I was learning were very fresh and in the moment, and it was an opportunity to document them, and I hope help people, especially memorization, which is a beast that changes throughout, certainly for me and for other musicians I've spoken to as well, throughout your life. Your relationship with memory changes because your brain changes and the way you memorize changes. And so it feels like something you're always having to catch up with to relearn how you memorize. And so all the lessons I learned through that, you know, I even forget them and listen to it.
Are there plans to record original music that you've created?
The next album, I think, you know, there's been a few discussions about what it's going to be. But I think that I've come more into my own in terms of improvisation and, you know, want to really hone my chops at that. And yes, closer to that, quite possibly. Yeah.
What's next for Harriet Stubbs?
Touring Living on Mars, which will be very exciting. And, you know, I've performed a lot in New York, and I'm actually playing it at City Winery on January 21st. It's going to be announced today, actually. And then perhaps a few of the other City Wineries as well. But we're discussing touring Asia as well. So I'm really looking forward to that.
Well, I'd like to thank you for taking the time to talk. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been really fun.
Harriet Stubbs with an original composition by Mike Garson, a longtime David Bowie keyboardist. Once again, I'd like to thank Harriet for taking the time to speak to us this evening. She has an album out, Living on Mars, which you can purchase on Amazon or I think Spotify and all those other web places have that. You might want to check her out at harrietstubbs.com. It's HarrietStubbs.com. She also has an Instagram page and much, much more. Once again, she'll be playing at City Vineyard on Tuesday, January 21st. That's at 233 West Street, Pier 26 on the Hudson River side of Manhattan. And that's going to wrap up tonight's edition of Davy Jones Locker. And as Monty Python would say, or John Cleese actually would say, and now for something completely different here on WUSB.